on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness to be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Welcome to the Happiness Algorithm, another episode of the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast, the show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, my guest today is described as the mental health spokesperson of our generation. He's a fashionpreneur, public speaker, and mental health campaigner. He's a young man who is known for his incredible honesty and no-filter approach to opening up and discussing his suffering. In 2014, he founded the award-winning fashion brand Maison des Choux out of his severe anxiety and OCD struggles. The brand has been recognized by the likes of Vanity Fair, no less, which referred to Maison des Choux as the fashion brand with a mental health cause at its heart. It's also won the British Fashion Startup Award for such an inspiring story. Since launching the brand, my guest has gone on to do public speeches and workshops in schools, colleges, and universities, sharing his story about how he started his fashion brand from such a dark, dark, difficult place. He tells the story of his battle with severe anxiety and OCD, not being able to leave his bedroom for 3 years and washing his hands up to 50 times a day. All this to now running this successful fashion label. My guest is an incredibly honest and open about his suffering and urges us all to be more open about our mental health, especially young men. Today, I'm hoping to hear about his journey and share with you what he has learned along the way. Please welcome to the show, George David Hodgson. George, how are you?
Thank you, James. That's quite an intro. I'm feeling good today. The sun's shining, it's warm, and I've got my t-shirt on. So yeah, I'm feeling good.
One of your t-shirts, I hope.
Yes, absolutely. It's the Warrior Not Warrior one.
Ah, oh, I love that one. For those that are not aware, if you go on to Maison des Choux, I'm saying this correct, right, George?
Yeah, Maison des Choux, yeah, yeah.
Excellent. Because I'm an uncultured swine, no less, and I didn't want to do it an injustice by mispronouncing it. I urge anybody to get onto the website and look at Maison des Choux, beautiful, beautiful garments, and check the Warrior t-shirt out. It's really nice, and was this one of your early pieces, George?
Yeah, this is one of the one of the pieces that launched actually in 2017. The brand was formed in around 2015, sort of quietly, or the project, I suppose, was formed around 2015 when I had the idea of wanting to do something. And the Warrior Not Warrior t-shirt came out in 2017 when it really found its feet, and it was kind of based on designs from being, you know, a warrior. It's quite hard to describe all the fears of a podcast, being a warrior, not a warrior.
Because
I was always worrying about just about everything, really. So it's about being that strong person, you know, tackling their worries and facing them head on.
And it is, you know, as Vanity Fair said, that it's the mental health cause is very much at the heart of the brand. It's ingrained and, pardon the pun, but stitched into the sort of fabric and philosophy of what you stand for.
Absolutely. The brand's ethos and the core of the brand is essentially all about mental health. When I started it as a little project, now obviously formed into a business, I always wanted to remain true to the fact that it was about sharing a positive message of mental health in a way that was subtle and non-triggering. You know, it was about encouraging people to talk about their mental health, but in a sensitive way. And that has been the ethos I've stuck with, or we've stuck with, throughout the whole kind of life of the brand today. And it's kind of carrying that message on, carrying it through all the time.
And you get many, obviously, you know, I urge all those to not only go onto George's, onto the website, but also watch some of the clips and listen back to some of your own podcasts. I say, apologies for not even sharing that in the intro, because you're a fellow podcaster as well, I might add, and some wonderful shows and guests that you've had on, again, talking quite candidly. But the BBC Three, I think, BBC, correct me if I'm wrong, the BBC yeah. Three excerpt and sort of filming you done for those, and spoke about your journey, and it shares some of the selling on the market store, as it were, and the brand. And what I found really powerful was the customers opening up and talking and sharing their difficulties and what they faced or what they've overcome as well. And I think that's beautiful, and what the brand has done, as we said at the top of the show, given people an opportunity to become that warrior, if you like, and not the warrior, to begin to fight, to see that we're all very much fighting our own battles.
Exactly. And that, as you mentioned, yes, it was BBC Three. It was an amazing humans documentary. The market store we discovered when I was manning it was, we put an A board out beside the stand that says mental health matters, and you know, 25% of proceeds goes to Your Minds charity. And when it was facing the mental health matters sign, it immediately engaged people that might be suffering or might be going through something to come into the stand, and one, browse the clothes. But actually, I found a lot of the time people started just talking to me about what they were going through, because that sign, that A board, had created a safe space for people to say, actually, I am suffering from mental health problems. This sign has just given me the reasons that I can talk about them. So with the stand, you know, and the clothing and the message, it's already encouraging those people to talk about their mental health in a way that is kind of unlocking the door for them to be able to do so.
For sure. Absolutely. And you know, sometimes I think people overthink how we can give people an opportunity to begin to share or talk, or how we can unlock the door, and the simplicity in our actions or our gestures sometimes can be where the beauty comes from, where that opportunity comes from. And as you say, and it really captures, there's a wonderful shot of you putting that A board out, and it's such, for me, the cinematography or the aspects of it being captured in that way, it normalizes it. It says, you know what, this is okay. This is all right. We're all here.
Yeah, that's the thing. And as you say, the hardest part is how do I talk about it? Where do I start? And who do I go to? These are all questions that people are thinking or overthinking when they're suffering. So when that A board is out and it says mental health matters, it's almost maybe I could start here. And actually, is there someone there I can talk to? And that was the plan, and it worked. And I hope the brand in itself, obviously, we stepped back from doing the market a little bit because it was getting very hard. But the brand in itself, I hope, still sort of portrays that message of this is the place to start.
Well, I believe it does. And, you know, there's what it represents, and some of the designers that you work with as well. And I'm sure we'll come on and talk a little more about this later in the show. But you know, if people are not perhaps necessarily ready to even talk, by purchasing, an item of your clothing, the T-shirts, that may be that initial stage for them to begin to own the difficulties that they are experiencing.
Yeah, and that's really it. When I did do the market stall, it was really interesting because a lot of, you know, high level people asked me, who's your target audience? And I quite honestly say, I have no idea, which I'd probably get a bit in trouble for. But the idea is that I don't know who my target audience. When I was doing that market store, I had the university students who really liked the designs because they were just very quirky, quite interesting designs. I had the parents buying it for the young people who may be going through mental health problems. And then I had the young people and the older people buying it because they suffered themselves. So there was such a diverse range of people who were actually interested in having one of the t-shirts to wear it to express themselves or buy it to someone so they could express themselves and start that conversation. You know, when you're wearing one of the t-shirts, you don't have to talk about your own experience. You can talk about where the brand came from. You know, oh, I bought this t-shirt, it's supporting mental health, and you know, that's something close to my heart. Or, oh, I bought this t-shirt because actually I've been going through something similar to how this brand was started. It's about mental health. And that's the real aim of the brand, really, is to start a conversation in any form, whether about yourself or just whether about mental health generally.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. You know, it's and there, I suppose there lies the challenge from you know, as you say, from high level business perspective, who becomes your target audience? Well, if we look at it from the perspective of mental health, well, we all have mental health in the same way we all have physical health, and we have to look after both. So the capture is far and wide, whether it be the individual that's in crisis or suffering or recovering, or an individual that knows of someone. And I think that's the beauty behind the movement and what you're doing and what you stand for. George, if we may, sort of dive into a little more of that. We're only putting the brand on temporary pause because I think that it would be lovely to hear your journey and your relationship with mental health and how that sort of emerges and organically transitions into Maison de Shoe. So take us back to sort of younger George, early George, and when you first started to experience difficulties and identify some struggles.
Sure. So I think going back quite far to my primary school days, I'd always had some sort of underlying mental health problem, but it was never diagnosed. It was never really picked up on. They just thought I had some sort of behavioural issue because I was very hyperactive. I used to run everywhere, fidgety, couldn't focus much. And that led me to having extra support at home. So I'd have a lady come over in the afternoon after school and do breathing exercises with me. And counting to 10. This is probably the early days of knowing that CBT existed, but I have no idea. And doing those breathing exercises to calm me down, you know, relax me, make me think more, slow my brain down, essentially, because I didn't have the greatest primary school experience. But I left primary school, went to secondary school, did really well, had a good friends group, achieving well, enjoyed it, I was having fun. And all of those sort of those tendencies tended to disappear. So I was still hyperactive, but I was putting that energy into my work, seeing my friends, socializing, becoming quite extroverted. I had somewhere to kind of dispel this energy. So it was, you know, through that I was absolutely okay. And I, you know, it's because I was so busy, GCSEs were stressful. You're kind of growing up at the same time, so there's a lot going on. But it was at the end of school when we were transitioning into college that I started to wobble again. And I wobbled quite severely. So we'd all finished our GCSEs and we thought we'll celebrate. And my birthday had coming up. So I got a birthday present of a ticket to a festival. This was a music festival down in Somerset, drum and bass or quite house music. And all my friends, you know, all of us, who, you know, it's the last time we'd probably properly be able to do this for a while. We thought we'd go to this festival. So we all go to this festival and we, you know, get lots of alcohol. We're still 16 at the time and actually experiment with some drugs. And the drugs we experimented with were MDMA, or commonly known as ecstasy. And I didn't really enjoy the experience. I started to feel like I was hallucinating, seeing things, hearing voices. Everything was too bright, too vivid, too loud. And I didn't really know what was going on. So I kind of didn't do it again, forgot about it. My friends were having a great time. My sister was there. She was quite supportive. She went with her friends. It was, you know, it was absolutely fantastic time because my sister was with her friends and I was with my friends. We had a great time apart from this little blip of experiencing the MDMA. Anyway, I forgot about it, left it. And then about a week later, we had a party and my friend said, oh, I've got some left over. Do you want to try it again? So I said, okay, you know, 16, young, ignorant, thought maybe I just had a little blip. And I had the same experience. I thought I was going to die. I kept thinking I was going to black out. I ran behind the shed and kind of curled up in a ball and didn't really enjoy it. And I sort of thought, well, I'm not doing that again, they are definitely not for me. You know, that's one experience I've learned young that I don't need to do. And from there, it was about 3 weeks after that experience that I was outside in the horse's field picking up dung, when I started to feel really hot, tunnel vision, sweating, heart racing, sort of 1,000 miles an hour. And I didn't really know what was happening. It felt very much like I was actually back on this drug. And I couldn't, you know, my brain couldn't rationalize it. So I thought, what on earth is going on here? So I thought, oh, I'm back on this drug. It's somehow still in my bloodstream and I'm back on it at my parents' house, you know, in the horse's field. What the hell's happening? So I ran inside and told my parents what had happened, about taking the drugs, about what I was experiencing. And we phoned the doctors and they told me I was having a panic attack. And this was my first experience of a panic attack. And I'd never had a panic attack. I hadn't really heard of what they were. And it was absolutely terrifying. It went on for about 45 minutes. And for that 45 minutes I thought that was the end of me. I thought I was going to die. I wanted to curl up. I wanted to run away. I wanted to cry. I was crying. But after that, you know, I got a paper bag and started breathing into it because I was hyperventilating. And it passed eventually, and the next day came along, and I then, you know, I was lying in bed doing nothing really, because it was the transitional period between college and school. So it was that weird time when you're just starting at college, and you don't really have much to do yet. So you're kind of not really doing anything in limbo. And I was lying in bed and I started again, feeling really hot, sweating, tunnel vision. But I was just doing nothing. I was lying. I couldn't understand what on earth was happening. And I was having another panic attack. And I had a panic attack every day for the whole week. And it became apparent there was something not quite right. So I told my parents this. I said, you know, Mum, Dad, can we go to the doctor, please? Something's not right here. And they said, yes, no, we agree. This is not you. You know, in a couple of weeks, you're having a great time with your friends. So we go down to the doctor and we get a doctor that's very luckily sympathetic with adolescent mental health. And he says to me, George, it sounds like you've got anxiety disorder with panic attacks and starting to develop OCD. And I was quite scared now because I hadn't heard of any of these things. Really. I didn't know what was happening, you know, what was about to happen to me. And he said, I'm going to refer you to CAM, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, under the NHS umbrella. And from there, it was a 2 week period from the doctor's appointment to the assessment at CAM. So I went downhill in those 2 weeks. I started having more and more panic attacks, felt like an hourly basis. I was carrying around this paper bag with me everywhere because it was my lifeline. It was my breathing into every time I had a panic attack. The anxiety worsened and I started washing my hands 50 to 100 times a day because I firmly believed in my head that there were drug traces on everything. So every time I touched a surface or touched a controller or a remote, I thought, oh, there might be drug traces. I've got to go and wash my hands. If I didn't wash my hands, I'd have a panic attack. And it was absolutely terrifying. It was getting exhausting. So I also started to experience intrusive suicidal thoughts as well. And this was in a 2 week period. So the CAMS appointment comes along and we go along as a family again. My sister's at university in London. We go along with my parents and we go and see a lady therapist, lovely lady therapist, who says, you know, tell me what's going on, George, what's happening? And from there, she says, you know, I tell her my story. My parents have sort of told her their side of the story of what they've been experiencing of me and my suffering. And she says at the end, you know, it's okay, George, we'll also help you. We'll get you through this. Everything's going to be fine. And then there's a pause and I'm feeling slightly relieved because I've just been told I can get help. I've been told what they're going to do to help me and which therapy techniques. And then she says at the end, I have to tell you, there's about a 40-week waiting list for this help. The room fell silent and we then left the mental health unit and went back to the doctors. So we went back to the doctors and my parents are now scared. I'm scared, you know, 40 weeks, would I be here in 40 weeks is a question. And the doctor says, he says one thing to my parents. He says, you know, can you afford to go privately? And it's very fortunate that my parents were in the position to go privately, that my road to recovery started. And that's, you know, through a year and a half of psychiatric help from an adolescent psychiatrist. He was dealing with the panic attacks. He also put me on medication. And after a year and a half with him, he referred me to a CBT therapist. And that was another year and a half. And the CBT therapy was dealing with the anxiety and the OCD and the catastrophizing and the irrational kind of thinking and the worst case scenario situations. And that was using CBT therapy techniques. So that was a year and a half. Then I slowly started getting weaned off my medication, and eventually became, you know, those two therapists and psychiatrists, they essentially rebuilt my brain, because my brain was completely very unwell, I suppose you could say. I was very poorly and I wasn't myself. So they rebuilt me, and I came out about three years later. And for those 3 years, I have to go everywhere with my parents. I couldn't go anywhere without my parents. I had to be with them all the time because I was scared for myself, and I didn't want to be alone. And I didn't leave my bedroom, really, unless I had to go somewhere essential, you know, for therapy or anything else, because I didn't have anything else to do. I started about half a year or the first year of college before I got way too poorly, and I had to leave, and I didn't have a job. So it was 3 years of therapy and essentially not leaving the house, and that's essentially for my therapy with my parents. Other than that, it was being stuck in my room, and it was being stuck in my room that I used to write down and draw my thoughts and feelings in these notebooks. I had loads of these notebooks because this was my way of expressing myself. I used creativity as my outlet. I'm a very creative person, not very academic. So I was writing down and drawing all my thoughts and feelings because I couldn't at the time talk about them. And I had loads of these drawings. And as I started to slowly get better, I went down to Dad's office with him. Getting out of the house, but still sticking, as you can hear, with my parents. And I was playing around with my designs on my laptop, adding colour, manipulating them, kind of just having a bit of fun with them, essentially. And realised that, these are quite interesting, these are quite cool, looking at them from a healthier side of my brain, thinking, these are really, you know, there's something here, these are quite dark, but they tell a story of suffering. And I wonder if they can share a message somehow. I didn't really quite know what I was thinking at the time, because I was obviously still a little poorly. But I thought maybe I could put it on something. Search Pinterest, thought I could put it on a poster, then I thought, not really, that's not going to do anything. And then I thought, what if I could wear my idea? What if I could wear my t-shirt and put some designs on them? So I had the sort of, you know, the classic light bulb moment. I thought, actually, I could wear it. I could wear my, if I was walking around wearing one of my drawings and someone said, you know, a family member or my uncle, my auntie said, what's that? And I could say, this is what I've been going through, and this is actually what I drew when I was suffering. And that is where the initial idea for Maison de Tube came from. It was through the suffering of using my drawings when I was very unwell, and applying them to a t-shirt to share my story, to start the conversation with myself and with my family. And the idea grew, and I thought, this could help other people somewhere. Then the idea for, obviously, Maison de Tube launched as a project, to see if it would work, see if there was any interest. But I thought I needed to give back to something, because obviously I was in the very fortunate position that I could go privately. And I thought, what on earth would have happened if I couldn't have gone privately? And what do people do that can't afford to go privately? And I remember when I was poorly, I Googled my symptoms, which is obviously a terrible idea, and we all know we shouldn't do that. But I came across a website called Young Minds. And Young Minds had a resource of all the symptoms of all the different mental illnesses or mental health disorders. And I clicked on anxiety and I related to all of the symptoms. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is me. I'm going through this. This is what I'm experiencing. And something in my brain realized that actually I wasn't alone. You know, if there is a resource for this, then there are other people going through the same situation. So when I launched the brand, I wanted to give back to Young Minds to help those young people not in the same position to go privately. And that's the sort of backstory of how the brand came to be.
What an incredible story, George. And thank you so much for sharing it here on the Happiness Algorithm. I think what fascinates me is how you were able to channel the energy that comes with anxiety and panic into good, into sort of an element of strength that aligned with your set of values. What I'm wondering is, was it about timing? Was it, you know, when you began to become connected with some of the drawings and the designs that you were creating, was it because it was a part of the recovery phase of your journey? Was it around actually moving to a point that felt safer to entertain some of these emotions and these ideas?
Absolutely. I think it started to become quite a cathartic process of a drawing down what I was feeling, because it would get the thoughts outside my head. There's too much thinking inside my head. I just have to get it out. So obviously I started writing them down and drawing them, but the actual process of thinking I could put this on a t-shirt or put this on something or a medium and find a medium to put it on to share it became part of the recovery in itself, and actually helped assist with my recovery. So I told my psychiatrist and my therapist about what I wanted to do and what I was doing, and they said, you know, keep going with it. That's a really good idea, really interesting, and it's also occupying a mind. So the project became a focus point outside of myself that was becoming a therapy in itself, I suppose you could say. I was researching, how can I print on a t-shirt? Who prints on t-shirts? What do you have to do? How can you start a business? How does it work? And all of this sort of research and focusing and looking into things became a different focal point. And I started putting the ideas on t-shirts and showing them in my therapy sessions when I went along, and they said, this is really interesting, keep going. So I had the encouragement as well of working on this project, and seamlessly realized that actually I was focusing less on myself and more worrying about, it's becoming a project. I don't want it to go wrong. How can I work on it properly? And it was, you know, it inadvertently helped me. So the process of trying to build a project and print on a t-shirt, you know, I bought myself a screen printing kit, set it up in Dad's office, and it went horribly wrong. I got paint everywhere. It was overexposed. And it didn't really work very well, which was a bit of a roadblock. So I thought, well, I'm not very good at screen printing, so I'm going to have to find someone else to print my t-shirts for me, and set about the journey of finding those people. So this all became as if I was at college or university. I'd started my own project and was focusing on that more than myself. And it was, yeah, it was helping me along the way.
It sounds also, and obviously please do correct me if I'm wrong, but what's lovely is that you've mentioned your sister a couple of times, Charlotte, I believe, is that her name?
Yeah, that's
Charlotte. And am I right in thinking actually the brand itself is named after her pet name? Is that right?
Yeah. So the name is, when I'm doing my project speeches, it's always the first question that I get asked when I'm doing them, is what does the name mean? And the name comes from, yes, a nickname for my sister Charlotte when I was younger. Now, Maison D is household in French. And Choup was Charlotte Poops put together, mashed into one. When I was young, I kind of put it in one and called her Choup, Choups. Yeah. So Maison the Choup actually is House of Charlotte, essentially, and it's a dedication in a way to how close we are. We're a very close family. My sister and I are incredibly close, and I feel very fortunate that I have that support network, especially with a sibling that close that I can talk to about anything, really, about how I'm feeling, about what I'm going through, about if I'm suffering. So it's essentially a little dedication to her, and yeah, it's House of Charlotte.
That's so wonderful to hear, and I think that's what comes across. You know, when you're retelling what you've been through, is there's a real closeness within that support network, within that family unit as well. Even, you know, as you're out in the horse field, you're picking up that dung and you experience that sort of panic episode. But you go back in and you speak to your parents, and that responsive nature of contacting a GP, of when we look at the sort of constituents of self-worth, The listeners have heard me say this on the show before, but the importance of our value sort of as human beings, what underpins our existence is relationship and the responsive nature of those relationships and what value they add to us. And it's based on four key constituents, whether we feel understood, taken seriously, listened to and respected. And you can see throughout that period of crisis and difficulty, there was a really responsive nature to all of those around you and the level of taking it seriously and understanding what you're going through. And what's lovely is that it carries through to the psychiatrist and to the CBT therapist as well, that you begin to foster and cultivate some great working relationships. And what I think is, for me, what really struck a chord, and I'm so pleased, is over and above maybe the specific interventions that you shared en route, that you was able in that relationship to share some of your designs, and there was that encouragement coming back from the professional to sort of say, go for it. This is, you've definitely got something here. It's really lovely to hear, because so often we can be lost in a medical or clinicalized model that we have to stay within the boundaries of what this particular theory represents. When at the end of the day, for me, it's about the individual and the journey and what they're going through and how you can sort of, you know, rebuild collectively over a period of time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I obviously, with the work I do now, I experience a lot. I'm actually an advisor, a youth advisor on the Amplify program, and an activist for Young Minds. And we do a lot of work, obviously, with the NHS. And you hear a lot of stories of young people feeling very disconnected from their therapists and their clinicians. And I look back at mine, I think they were still within their boundaries. They were talking to me about what I was up to and how I was doing with my day. And I was telling them, I was relaying them what I was up to. They were being paid to fill the hour of that therapy session. But what could be talked about within that hour was completely up to me and them. And because I was starting to get better, they could see that this project was actually helping me in a way that expressed myself. And it was still a professional relationship. You know, I went away, I didn't then see them in between or text them in between unless it was an emergency. It was still that working relationship of healing me, basically, but just keeping them up to date on what I was doing outside of me suffering. And that's what they want to hear, really. It's, how are you? And what have you been up to help yourself? And this project was helping me.
Yeah. And I think, as you said earlier, and for me, it's a fantastic sort of strap line, really, is the brand or almost the development was a focus point outside of myself. And as you said, that with many people that are struggling with intrusive thoughts and certainly panic and anxiety episodes, it all becomes internally focused, and that's can be a really difficult and almost debilitating to be sometimes. And I really like that. I really like that statement. It was a focus point outside of myself. That's lovely, George. Let's go into your first piece of music. Now, the listeners those eagle-eared listeners will have detected that I've said first piece of music, because George has chosen, he was offered two song choices. We have a song and a piece of music, but you know, it's semantics and people can argue that point, but I'm going to allow this piece to take hold. Please sit back, relax and enjoy George's first piece.
Thank you. Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. And I'm joined, my special guest today is George David Hodgson, the founder, the fashionpreneur, the leader of the brand Maison de Choux, as well as being a public speaker and mental health campaigner. And that was his first choice. Now, I've got to get this right now. As I said to you, I am an uncultured swine, so I will do my best. That was Symphony Number 3, Lento e Largo Tranquillissimo. Well, I gave it my best shot, George. You know, as my old nan would say, you can take the boy out of the East End, but you can't take the East End out of the boy. I've done it my best. George, what an amazing piece of music.
Thank you. Yeah, it's almost when I first heard it, I was actually very poorly, and it was on the radio, and I thought, what on earth is this this amazing piece of music. It first sounds quite mournful, and it's actually from Henri Gorecki's Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, which, you know, is quite dark, but it opens up into this rather stunning and hypnotic, you know, vocals or hummings, singing, and it's just beautiful. I it's obviously quite long, it's about 9 minutes long, but throughout the whole 9 minutes, and every time I listen to it, it kind of puts me into a trance. It completely takes me out of myself, and I'm listening to every component of the piece of music. And it was when I was very poorly, it really calmed me down. You know, the first opening, it immediately kind of, I dropped my shoulders, relaxed, took a deep breath, and it just, you kind of explore the journey of the whole rather beautiful and stunning piece of music. I found it absolutely incredible, and it still helps to calm me down today.
It is captivating, and you're right, it is a journey. It was an absolute journey of joy, and listening to it there, I'd sort of put my pen down and I sort of closed my eyes, and I just allowed the piece of music to take me, and it made me think about, you know, we do live in a society that is so fast paced. There's such an urgency about our existence, and even I wonder sometimes whether music is about, how do we, you know, listen, it's not my field, but certainly is it about consumption, the consumption rate, you know, song after song. But whereas, as you right, quite rightly say, 9 minutes, 27 seconds long, that piece. And it does allow you to surrender yourself to it and allow the piece to carry you through. And I'm so grateful that you shared it with us, with it being such an important part of your journey, and still to this day, you know, it's you can take yourself away and that piece sort of allows your shoulders to drop, that physical sense of being present again and breathing and regaining composure in the crazy world that we live in.
Yeah, that's exactly it, James. It's sort of, for 9 minutes, you feel completely calm. It's almost escapism in the form of a piece of music, and you can escape for those 9 minutes and think, gosh, you know, we do need to slow down a little bit sometimes.
We sure do. We sure do. George, now, before we took that break, you shared your journey and from that sort of late adolescent period into early adulthood, over that three and a bit years of what you were experiencing and the challenges that you faced as well. And I wonder if we could take a deeper dive into, you know, some of those really difficult, dark moments, and what that was like for you.
Yeah, so, I mean, at the kind of lowest point, it was those suicidal thoughts. It was so hard. My world shrunk completely. My world actually changed, you know, complete turnaround. Obviously I couldn't leave the house. My friends came and visited me once. I was sat on the floor in my bedroom, just reading a book, I think, and I barely said a word, but they were talking to me, and I was not really listening, I don't think. But I was very grateful, you know, that tiny bit of human interaction helped. But then it got less and less because I kind of became more reclusive and started hiding away and not leaving and not keeping in touch with anyone. So I feel quite understandably that everyone started to fade away and disappear, because I was fading away and almost disappeared. I deleted my Facebook, I deleted Instagram, I know all my social media accounts I got rid of. So I almost vanished from existence in the way that I wanted to be alone, so alone. And obviously going back to that piece of classical music, I couldn't listen to my music that I used to listen to. And we can say music, I had to listen to classical pieces of music. And I got bought an album for my birthday, my 18th birthday, when I was at the height of one of my illness. And it was now 50s, most relaxing piece of classical music. And I listened to it all the time on repeat. And obviously it was a daily battle with those suicidal thoughts and with those dark thoughts of when will this get better? When am I going to be normal again? And when will I get through this? because when you are suffering, when you're ill, the first thought is, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? And almost the second thought is, okay, I want to get better in about 2 weeks. And you don't, you know, it took me 3 years. And once you accept that actually it takes time to get better, you will start to be on the road to recovery in a way that is, I suppose, you're at peace with yourself that it's going to take a little bit of time. And actually, I'm not very well. And I understand that. It's just one of those moments in life that I'm going to get through, because we all have those moments. They come at different times and different stages of our life. But you will go through some dark times. It just so happened that mine was at 16, and I took 3 years to recover. But I never say you fully recover. You never fully recover from what you've experienced, anxiety, OCD, and panic attacks. And I'm actually going through another one now at the moment, only with severe health anxiety. You know, the pandemic and the lockdown, and my granny passed away a couple of months ago. It's brought on another, I suppose, for want of a better word, episode of anxiety. Only this time it's come out in the form of health anxiety. So going back to when I had my first illness, it just takes time. But understanding that there is light at the end of the tunnel, there is hope, it makes it a little bit more bearable and easier to get through.
And do you think that it's important to have, and not just from a professional perspective when we mentioned the CBT therapist and the psychiatrist in the past, but do you think it's important to have people around that are seeing us, that are doing their best to understand the position we're in? Does that help with that recovery?
I think yes and no. I think the most important thing is, yes, people need to understand obviously what you're going through. You're still the same person. You're just having a little bit of a hard time. What the psychiatrist, interestingly, and without bringing too much of the professionals back into it, the psychiatrist, I remember my doctor, he brought my parents in for the first three sessions of the psychiatry and the therapy and the hypnotherapy techniques he was doing. He was talking to them first for about three of the sessions. I thought, what is going on here? Because they needed the knowledge to understand how to manage what I was going through, because they were almost tearing their hair out. You know, mental illness can tear a family apart, and you have to be very careful about how to manage it. So they needed some, you know, coping mechanisms, some ideas, and a little bit of knowledge of how to manage me, what I was going through. So I think the most important thing or piece of information he gave them was to not tread on eggshells and treat him normally. Don't treat him if there's something wrong with him. Just treat him as you do usually, as if, you know, everything's okay. Because I think as soon as they started treating me differently, my brain would panic that something was wrong. I think, what's going on? Why am I being treated differently here? So I think, yes, absolutely, it does help having people around you that understand, but also that just treat you normally. You know, the bit of that my friends came around and were just talking to me, they didn't act as if I was ill or unwell or poorly or going through something. They were just talking to me as if I was normal. And that really helps when you're going through something, but also just understanding and being there. You know, what I felt or what I did have was that if I was in distress or I needed someone to talk to, I always knew that they were there and I could talk to them. And that is incredibly comforting when you're suffering.
The knowledge, I think, is the part that stands out for me, in the sense that you mentioned it with regards to yourself, you know, not understanding, you know, in those initial times, coming back from the festival and being out in the field and not knowing what's happening. And, you know, even the referral to CAMHS and, you know, the lovely lady you first met and her saying, look, we're going to get you better relief. But then the tragedy of the 40-week wait. But again, you know, it's understanding what's going on ahead. And I was going to ask about parents, actually, because of that intimacy and closeness within the relationship, how they were getting on. And I'm pleased that you've come on to them. But I think the part around them beginning to understand more of what you're going through, but the importance of treating you normally, And I think I see it myself that, you know, when we are in a hypervigilant state, when we've got heightened and elevated levels of anxiety and there are panic episodes presenting every 10 minutes or so, you know, it's our brain's way of perceiving a threat or a danger on our existence. And so I'm over the moon that you've mentioned that, because I think for parents or for loved ones, or as you quite rightly pointed out, your friends coming over as well, the normality is crucial, because if they start doing something different, if parents start being something different to what we normally expect, the hypervigilant individual, the sense of being on guard will think, this is all, you know, coming away at the seams now. Everything's changing, you know, the unpredictability of it. So parents, George, obviously, because you've got that open relationship and closeness, since you've, you know, where we are now and that difficult period that you went through, have you had conversations about that 16 to 19 period of time and crisis that you went through? Have you sat down and spoken about it as a family?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we always look back on it actually as a learning curve. And they've learned so much from it. They've learned themselves, the parents, to realize and recognize how big the problem mental health is in young people. And they're incredibly, you know, fortunate and grateful that they could send me privately, and they were able, as a family unit, we're able to talk about it. But we do regularly, you know, in the afternoon, we sit down, have a cup of tea and kind of look at where we are now, but look at where we've been at the same time. You know, we've been through, it was probably the hardest period of not just my life, but also an incredibly steep learning curve for them. They didn't quite know what was going on, and it was starting to affect all of us because they didn't know what to do. I was controlling the environment, you know, changing the music when it wasn't something that calmed me down, and changing the radio in the car, and it was controlling. So I think it's important to look back on it and recognize that, yes, it was hard, but also we went through it, and we went through it together, and we're a lot stronger for it. And the fact that we can talk about it is probably the most important thing to take from it.
For sure. It's interesting. A previous guest of mine, Johnny Benjamin, who I believe you know as well, very well.
I do.
Johnny, very similar in terms of what he's gone through and family as well. And the support that his family got was vital in terms of his being able to move forward with his challenges and understanding and knowledge as well. And I believe his father actually gives talks on it as well from the alternative perspective, from the parents' perspective of what they're going through. Interestingly, and I'm sure there are many parents that listen to this, the emotions that your parents ever mentioned, the sort of the difficulty they went through, obviously, but the emotions they experienced as well.
Yeah, they did at the time. They don't so much anymore. I think the overwhelming emotions was fear and kind of in a way pain of not knowing how to deal with it initially at first, and how scary it was that I was experiencing suicidal thoughts, because I suppose as a parent you can feel somewhat powerless when one is suffering from a mental illness, because it's inside. You know, if you broke an arm or you broke an egg, your parents can take you to the hospital and fix you. With your brain, it's slightly different, and it must be terrifying to not know how to manage it, to deal with it, to fix it. Instinctively, parents know how to fix things from bringing you up, but when it comes to the brain and thoughts and that, you can almost feel powerless. So I think frustration, fear, and you know. Yeah, I think those probably were the most overwhelming, but also, you know, a little bit of hope that we could talk about it. And they always say to this day, you know, when they're talking to other people, and I'm there, and they say, "Well, George's story," and usually the first thing they say is, "We're very lucky that George was able to talk about it," because there are young people that fear talking about it with their parents, and that is the hardest part. So a lot of emotions, I think, was pain, fear, but there was hope as well.
I think I was just scribbling some of those down, and I think that they're very close to what we as individuals would experience through going in crisis as well. So there's that sort of dual aspect to it as well, that the frustration, the fear, the powerlessness, sense of being overwhelmed. But there is that hope. Through all of that pain, there is that hope. And I think that's a crucial point you make, what your parents say to friends and others as well, that they feel and felt lucky that that you had a voice and felt confident enough and courageous enough to share what you was going through with them. And is that, you know, we mentioned at the opening and at the top of the show with regards to, you know, you are a pioneer for encouraging young people, particularly young men, to open up about their mental health and find that voice. Is that where that comes from, that passion to drive that forward?
I think so. I think when I was recovering, I think one of the first things that came out of it was I would come away from my therapy sessions and I'd talk about everything I was going through and what I was experiencing and come away feeling, you know, good and feeling good. But obviously, because I had anxiety, as soon as I started feeling good, I panicked. So I'd then not feel so good. But what it was that was making me feel good was actually talking about it and thinking, well, actually that helps, you know, actually just getting it out there, getting it in the open. There's no shame in realizing that I have a mental health problem sometimes. And then the passion to talk about it further came when obviously started the brand and I was meeting people and I was sharing on Instagram and social media. Now by this time got all my social medias back in a new form. And was really just open about it. And I went from meeting with a contact of mine, and she said, why don't you tell your story in person? I'm forever grateful for her putting me in touch with, and she got me a speaking opportunity at Condé Nast College of Fashion and Design. And the personality I am is I say yes to everything because I want to try all these opportunities. So this is quite a while after I got better. You know, this was in probably 2018 now. But I thought, yeah, because from my experience of sharing it on Instagram, I got people messaging me saying, you know, that actually you sharing, you're going through something, it's helped me and encouraged me that I'm not alone. So I thought, well, how can I amplify my voice? How can I share this further? And then this opportunity came up. Now, it was quite terrifying at first because I looked at the website of Condé Nast, the college, and realized that the previous speakers were Tommy Hilfiger, Victoria Beckham, and I started panicking slightly that I was just a young boy coming along and telling my story about suffering from mental health problems. So I went along, I got someone to help me with my speech. I spoke to my uncle and said, this is what I'm going to share. Does it sound okay? And generally the feedback was really good and said, this is going to help people. So I told my story and dry mouth, drinking lots of water, and it sounded probably really, you know, monotone. And there were not many questions, and I thought, oh, you know, it's a flop. And then afterwards, I got a flurry of messages on my Instagram saying, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. This has just highlighted to me that actually I'm going through the same thing, and I've experienced this. And someone else said, I've experienced this, and I've taken the drugs, and actually I realized I'm suffering from the same thing. So I realized that by just talking about my story was not only helping me, but it was helping other people who were going through the same thing. So the passion for it kind of grew and grew. And that passion was stemmed from A, the therapy, and recognizing that talking about it really helped me. But then also helping other people at the same time. And I thought, if I can use my voice to share my story and help others, then I'll absolutely do it.
Yeah, and I, you know, the listening to you talk in the way that you do, George, and I mean, we, you know, we've had a conversation off air previous to the show, and you're so open and honest and courageous with the connection, and I think you retell it with such transparency and rawness that the connection, you can't help but feel pulled into it. And for me, it's because of the accuracy of the language you use around the emotions. And you know, I've said before that it's very, very difficult at times to find the right words that accurately represent how we're feeling. I think the English language is flawed, or perhaps my repertoire of words perhaps is flawed. But I think it's very difficult sometimes to externalize that felt sense. But I think what you do so well, George, is you do retell the story with such openness, and that enables many to connect with that because of your use of language and those emotions that you do mention. We must play your second song. It's terrible. There's me. I did warn you, George, didn't I? I did say off air that I do end up talking too much, or I get too enthralled into the conversation. This is the Happiness Algorithm. I'm James Rose. My special guest today is George David Hodgson, and this is his second song choice. Thank you.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. And my special guest today is George David Hodgson, and that was his second song choice. And that one, this one I can say, that was Talking Heads, This Must Be the Place. George, another great song choice there.
Yeah, it's one of my favourites, actually. I love it. It always puts me in a good mood, and it just makes everything while I'm listening to it feel more bearable. You know, even if it's a gloomy day, or even if you're not feeling great, if you listen to that song, it just feels like, oh, you know, this will pass. This is going to pass. It's going to be okay. Just because it's quite cheerful, and obviously with the sun out today and it being beautiful weather, it makes it even nicer. Yeah, and it's obviously in the famous 1980s film Wall Street as well. And that's a great scene. Mm. So, yeah, I just love it.
It is a great song, and I think that we should all find and connect with songs that do lift us. And again, you know, we mentioned Johnny earlier in the show, but Johnny Benjamin really promoted having a playlist of songs that you're constantly sort of evolving and changing and dropping in and dropping out to meet our mood, to lift us out of those
sort of more
challenges or darker periods. Now, I must share with the listeners, because George was very kind during that musical interlude to point out that it isn't just me where words fail me, because quite rightly, George has another t-shirt which is entitled Words Fail Me. It's the Words Fail Me t-shirt, and a beautiful t-shirt, a beautiful garment it is too. And check it out online and purchase one, because it is it's a great t-shirt and encapsulates everything that we've been discussing. Sometimes words do fail us, and it is difficult to say where we are at all of the time. But you know what you have done, George, I think so eloquently and so well during this show is paint this very turbulent and difficult at times narrative that does uplift, a lot like the first piece of music. It starts very raw and almost quite dark, but then transitions organically and begins to grow and blossom and turn into something quite beautiful. So George, share with us what the next 12 to 18 months looks like, or where do you want it to go, or you know, the coming weeks and months, where are you embarking on, George? What's your adventure going to be?
Well, it's an interesting question, James. Obviously, with the world being turned upside down, it's a matter of for want of a better phrase, adapting and surviving. And with the business, we've been doing some great work. We released a competition for people to design a t-shirt to support the NHS. So we did that, we launched that, and that's raised quite a lot of money for the NHS. And from that idea, it was trialing something that is about bringing people together. And the brand for me, although it's always been about my story, I wanted to share other people's story. I wanted it to be a community, you know, a platform for people to share their own story, to raise their voice, you know, and say, actually, I suffer from this, and this is my design. And that's where the brand is going. It's about bringing people together, sharing the work of other designers that have been affected by mental health problems, and continuing to grow a community and raise the conversation around mental health in a positive, subtle, and non-triggering way. So that's the future of the brand. And then there's obviously myself, and I'm going to continue doing work virtually at the same time as when we can get back to normal, hopefully going in and doing my workshops and public speaking, but also looking at trying to work with companies and how they can change their culture inside. Because what I see a lot, or what I fear, is, you know, mental health problems should be about early intervention and prevention. If I had the knowledge to combat what I was experiencing before it happened, I could have recognized it and got help sooner, because I didn't have any knowledge. You know, at school, if I'd known, oh, these are the sensations of a panic attack, this is a normal part of life, this is because something's happened, this is the normal reaction. But I didn't have any of those tools. So I want my work to explore the idea that schools, you know, when I came out of school, I obviously had my GCSEs, but I also knew about drugs. My eyes had been open to them because they said, don't take them. That's how they told us. That's what they taught us. Don't take drugs. They're bad for you, which doesn't really work. But also they taught me how to put a condom on a banana. I had no knowledge of how to myself. I had no knowledge of myself. I didn't know what anxiety was. I didn't know what depression was. I didn't know what a panic attack was. And I fear there's a lack, although it's getting better and they're starting to introduce it into the curriculum, there's a lack of knowledge for young people. You know, they should know what a panic attack is and they should be able to recognize the signs and go to the doctor when they feel ready and think, no, it's just a panic attack. If I monitor it, if it gets worse, then I can go to the doctor. But that's not happening. And that's where I want my work to go, essentially, with myself and obviously working with Young Minds and the NHS. And the flip side of that is companies. We see a lot of companies who are very hot on the mental health, but it's a reactive response. So they've got mental health first aiders, which is, again, reactive. So if someone's having a panic attack, they can go to their mental health first aider or manager. But do they feel comfortable going to their manager and saying, actually, I'm really anxious this week, or my depression's flaring up this week. Can I have a week off to feel better? Do they feel comfortable doing that? And the majority of people say no. It's because it's the proactive responses we need. And encouraging that culture of, actually, yes, I feel comfortable going to my manager and saying that. But people don't feel that comfortable at the moment. So obviously with the work and the business, they're quite intertwined. I've got myself, my kind of advisory work, my ambassador and activism, but also growing the brand as a community and getting more people involved and sharing other people's stories to encourage more people, become a safe space.
Well, George, you're a courageous mental health warrior. For me, you know, the pushing at those, well, let's use a phrase you said earlier. It's unlocking those doors and giving people that opportunity to approach their managers and say it and beginning to maybe infuse and ignite some courage within the individuals that are struggling. And listen, I'm making it sound a lot easier than it is. I understand that when we are in crisis, it is a position of vulnerability and therefore sort of strength is hard to come by. But I think what you epitomise, George, is the fact that it can be done. Going back to a point you made earlier when, you know, you mentioned recovery and you said you never fully recover. I suppose it's that, again, with the current climate, it's that adaption. How do we adapt as creatures? It reminds me of a theory or something I read many years ago about, you know, the transition from childhood or sort of mid to late adolescence into adulthood, and which is a turbulent time at the best of times. But it unlocks or it opens or it fractures the fragility of our existence, and all of a sudden, life doesn't ever really make sense again. It's never ever straightforward, and so therefore, you know, can we ever recover? I remember speaking at a conference once to the head of Hospice Care UK, I believe she was, and she said the only terminal illness is life itself. And so I suppose in line with what you've said there, we never really recover because we're still existing, we're still living, and so therefore we're always faced with the challenges that life presents at our doors. But the bit that enables us to keep moving forward is knowledge. And as you said, you know, by changing a culture, we can only change that culture by knowledge, and that will combat many of our challenges as we're going forward, that understanding.
Yeah, it's about, there's a quote, I forget exactly what it says, but the end of it is about learning to dance in the rain. And that's essentially what life is. You know, you're going to go through life with struggles. It's about learning to take them on board, accept them, and work with them. And as a sort of side note, as you mentioned, the world has been turned upside down. And I feel that obviously there is going to be the next pandemic that we're going to see, or epidemic, is going to be a mental health one, because people are going to come out of this lockdown and their lives are going to be turned upside down. People will have lost loved ones, and maybe they've been furloughed, and it's going to be incredibly hard to get back to normality. So I kind of wanted to say on a little bit of a direction, different directional changes, that it's okay. You know, if you've been experiencing mental health or suffering from depression or anxiety or severe health anxiety during the pandemic, it's okay, because you're definitely not alone. And I myself have also been suffering quite badly, as I mentioned at the start of the show, health anxiety, or hypochondria. It's been completely overwhelming, so bad in fact that I thought I can't, you know, I'm actually back in therapy and seeing a psychotherapist to help me, or a psychologist to help me get through it, and I'm reading again. But I also built, as a way of this, of my way of coping, when we Google our symptoms or try and find the answers, our brain always needs to find the rational thing when you're suffering from something or where it thinks it's in danger. I actually, I couldn't find a community of people that suffered from health anxiety. And I just needed someone to share their story and say, you know, yeah, actually I've got health anxiety and I feel all the same sensations you do. So I built one, and it's called Help for Hypochondriacs. But it was my way of managing it. I thought, well, I'm going to build one and invite other people to share their story as a safe space to do so. Because
that's incredible. So share a little bit more about that, please, George.
So obviously, early months of 2019, I lost my grandma. That was in 2019, and I kind of got past it. I had a little bit of health anxiety. I thought, you know, I had cancer or something worse. I went to the doctor, and it was a part of grief, you know, the physical sensations for grief. But I was working and I was getting on with life. So it disappeared a little bit. However, this time when I lost Granny during lockdown, a couple of months ago, my brain hasn't quite processed what happened. And because it hasn't had time to do that, and I haven't been thinking of other things, I've been stuck inside the house and not doing much. It's been ruminating on it too much. So it's been starting to fester and think, what if you have something? What if you've got MS? What if you've got bowel cancer? What if you've got a brain tumor? And it keeps thinking and thinking all these things, to the point where your brain starts painting the picture and that you're convinced you do have it. And our brains are incredibly powerful, that they'll connect the dots and then you're convinced you have something. So I started suffering obviously quite badly with it now that it's affecting my day-to-day life. So I thought, you know, I've accepted I need help and I'm quite poorly with it. So I'm seeing a psychologist about it, but also I built Help for Hypochondriacs to create that community, because I know it's quite a quiet anxiety disorder, health anxiety, and a lot of people feel shame for suffering with it because they feel like they're a burden or annoying the doctors. So I essentially wanted to build, you know, that community of people that feel comfortable talking about it. So it's got the community page, it's got loads of resources, podcasts, books that you can buy, related articles, just a safe space for people to go to if they think they're going through the same thing. Because I thought, well, this is what I'd need this is what I want when I'm looking at, you know, health anxiety or hypochondria. I just want something to tell me that actually I'm not alone again. So it kind of came out of the fact that, you know, I've been suffering myself and it's there to encourage other people. So it's just launched. You know, there's my story on there. There's another girl's story on there. It's got ambassadors. And I'm hoping it's just going to be a kind of resource to help others that might be experiencing health anxiety pre and post pandemic.
What a wonderful platform for people to, as you say, connect and share and gain some of that knowledge. And you're right. I think, you know, health anxiety is one of those misrepresented or underrepresented presenting disorders or symptoms or feeling states. And interestingly, you're quite right to point out the increased or elevated presentations of individuals that are experiencing some of these symptoms as a result of the pandemic, because, you know, quite often when we're faced with the unknown, the brain requires such certainty, you know, but when we're faced in a world that is unpredictable and completely uncertain, no more so than now, it can become quite rife and difficult. And it can be such a debilitating position sometimes, health anxiety, because what our brain craves through health symptoms is it knows that there's a certainty, it knows that there's almost a medical model to follow. And so we start to investigate and meander and drive a more aggressive curiosity to some of these physical symptoms in an attempt to give us some stability or understanding. And working with individuals in the past that have almost reached a point of, you know, desperately craving a terminal illness because it would give them a route, a map out of a position of crisis. But, you know, rationally speaking, they're not wishing this terminal illness, but just some substance, just something to grab onto, traction to lift them out of this state. And I think, you know, everything you've done and everything you stand for, George, is as I say, admirable. And this just sits alongside that health platform, that health anxiety platform for people to share and understand. And a lot like the t-shirts, even if they're not, you know, in a position or confident enough to post anything, but they can just read and they can begin to connect with others that are that are struggling. George, what would you, I mean, you've shared so much and I am so grateful of what you've shared so far. Are there any other sort of particular words of wisdom or advice you can share with the listeners about what you've learned on your journey and what maybe they can do going forward and consider over these coming weeks and months?
I think obviously the first point to note or to recognize is that however you're feeling, it's absolutely okay to feel that way, and it's absolutely okay not to be okay. The second one is, whenever you feel ready, you can talk about it. Only you know when you'll feel ready. There's no pressure to talk about it. There's no, you know, no one's rushing you. When you feel ready to open up and say, okay, this, I need some help. Whenever you feel ready to do that, that's the first step. By talking about it, it's the first, hardest, and most important step. But once you've said, I'm suffering and I need some help, you'll feel almost like it's a relief. You know, you've alleviated some of that anxiety already by saying, I have anxiety. As an example, if you have social anxiety or you're an anxious person or you go to a social gathering, although not at this time, or you're on a phone call and you say, you know, you say, oh, actually, I've got a little bit of social anxiety or I have anxiety, then you feel like, oh, okay, no, other people will understand. Whereas if you're quiet and people say, oh, why are you being quiet or why are you being weird or certain, you know, these things that people think and you think they're thinking and going to say, then if you've already told them, it will alleviate it. So I think that the most important bit is obviously whenever you feel ready, is to open up and talk about it and say, you know, I'm going through this and this is, I'm actually getting help for it. I'm managing it, but this is what's happening to me. So I think that's, you know, I wouldn't say I'm very wise, but that's from my experience is the bit that helped me is saying, actually, I'm a bit poorly. I need some help, but it's going to be okay. And another thing is, you know, if you are starting to feel low or feel anxious or feel your depression coming back, is to step back a bit. Take a day off work if you're working from home, if you've been furloughed or whatever you're doing, it's okay to take a step back and have a duvet day, you know, because you know you'll feel better for it. That's what I do. You know, I think if I'm starting to get anxious or my health anxiety is getting worse, I'll go for a walk and I'll take a step back because I know that that one day off will help me feel better for a couple of months or a couple of weeks or that week. And there's no shame in needing to do that.
Sorry for the long pause there, George. I was busy scribbling notes okay. down because, you know what, I've not heard that for so long, take a duvet day. And that has actually just ignited a real old memory from some time ago. And I think you're absolutely right. Because as you was talking, I was thinking that, you know what, look, there's no shame in re-seeking help as well. As you said, the recovery phase, we don't recover as such. It's, you know, life itself continues on. And we have to be able to track that narrative and connect with what we're experiencing. And, you know, in inverted commas, as you've said, quotation marks, take a step back. If we don't take that step back, we can't understand or we can't hear what's going on. And then make an informed decision, a sort of psychologically informed decision, what we need to do, whether that is taking a duvet day, whether that is speaking to our boss, line manager, mental health first aider, saying, look, you know, I need some time out, or whether it is, you know, looking to go out and increase our knowledge and you know, get some professional help that that will enable us to get through.
That's the thing.
Yeah. It's George, it's been absolutely incredible speaking to you. Before we sign off, please share your social media. I know you're very active on social media, and you mentioned there with the, you published a fantastic post about the health anxiety. Again, I'd urge people to go back and see that little snippet of video that you that you've published, because like today, you're very open and very candid about what you're experiencing. But please do share social media handles and your websites and etc.
Sure. So the brand is at maisonthetube.com. www.maisonthetube.com. Its Instagram is at maisonthetube. Facebook, maisonthetube. Twitter, maisonthetube. So that's all easy. They're all the same. My personal one is at George David Hodgson on Instagram. At Twitter, I'm George Hodgson. And then the podcast is the Talking About podcast, which can be found via maisonthetube again. And then the new little resource for health anxiety or hypochondriacs, whichever word you want to use, is helpforhypochondriacs.org.uk.
Excellent. So you've heard that, guys. So log on, follow, click, subscribe, and do listen to some of George's podcasts as well, because they are they're excellent. And go through the website as well and check out the BBC Three talk that George gives as well. That too is excellent. George, I'm going to, if I may, share with you and the listeners what I've taken from today. And it will come out in random order, because my notes, if you could see me sitting here now at the desk, there are scribbles all over the place. But for me, as I just said, that there's no shame in sort of seeking help. You know, we're not broken. You know, it's an ongoing, evolving state. Take a step back, take a duvet day if we need it. You know, for a culture to change, whether that be an external culture, work in school, family, or our internal culture, our internal emotional environment, knowledge is key and crucial, and that will shift and change that culture. Obviously, from a controllability factor perspective, we've got a greater level of control over our internal culture, and that's where we should start. For parents and loved ones and those in support of individuals that are in crisis, don't tread on eggshells. You know, treat them normally, but again, utilize the knowledge that you can access. And to quote some wonderful phrases you've used, George, and in line with the brand, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay not to be okay. And, you know, we talk when we're ready. The emotions that you've sort of batted out for us today around frustration and fear and powerlessness and overwhelmed and pain and, you know, but there is always hope. We will always come out the other side, and talking is key. The opportunity to talk with others. Well, do you know, look, what an absolutely filled to the brim packed show, George. I just want to express my thanks and gratitude for coming on. I know so many people will take so much from the show. You're a courageous young man. You're a very open and honest young man. And it's been an incredible show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, you know what, George, before we sign off, I always hand over to Mr. Tom Hanks himself, to see what he thought of the show. So, Tom, how did today's show go?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you very much. I would agree with you there. My guest today has been the wonderful George David Hodgson. Thank you for listening today. I've been James Roast. This has been the Happiness Algorithm. Be safe, be healthy, and be happy.
Daisies swaying, free in the breeze, the birds in the trees are singing along with me. I'm just looking for happy. Sunrise lights my smiley face clock, sliding in my socks. I pour my first cup of tea. Just looking for happy. If you open your heart, you will see there's a million little opportunities to be looking for happy, looking for happy. Magical fights as the rain taps so tepidly. I'm just looking for happy. In the sand, your head on my shoulder, drinking the moment the sun falls into the sea. I'm just looking for happy. Yeah, I'm just looking for happy.
Phoenix FM.